Studio 360.
I'm drawing you right now.
Is that what you're drawing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, hi, it's Maeve Higgins again, filling in for Kurt Anderson, whoever that is. And I was recently joined in studio by writer Molly Crabapple, who brought in her sketchbook. Wow, that's cool. So is it distracting while I'm talking, or you can do both, it seems like?
I can do both.
Yeah. So Molly is a freelance artist and journalist, illustrating and reporting on conflicts around the world. You can find her stuff on Vice, the New York Times, and more recently I've been following her in the New York Review of Books. Her work captures haunting moments that cameras are not able to. I mean, literally not able to. Like the inside of Guantanamo Bay detention camp, where photography is restricted. I think the work that really resonates with me a lot are the drawings of people, like the faces of asylum seekers at the Texas border, or the people living in these bombed out neighborhoods in Gaza. And then the way she draws them, they're sort of covered in her own accidents, red and black splotches. And her work just gives this subjective, like really on the ground perspective that I certainly haven't seen anywhere else. Molly also collaborated with Syrian writer Marwan Hisham to capture life inside ISIS-occupied Syria. And together they created this extraordinary book. It's called Brothers of the Gun. And it was nominated actually last year for a National Book Award. Now, Molly would keep sketching me throughout the interview, but we started off by her showing me what else was in her sketchbook.
This is my Puerto Rico / India sketchbook. It has drawings from the recent protests in Puerto Rico and also of a farmer's march in India last year.
I've been pronouncing Puerto Rico wrong. Not for the life. So wait, you were in India. What were the farmers protesting about and who were you covering it for and what was your role there?
The farmers are protesting climate change and also these unpayable debts. And I believe it was over 1 million people from all over India. They walked to Delhi and they protested in front of the parliament.
Can I have a look at one of the farmers' march pictures?
Yes.
Look at that. This is incredible.
Thank you. Yeah, they had these unionized Sikh guys and they were very, very handsome, dapper guys, even though they'd been walking for God knows how many miles.
Did I see them somewhere? Did you publish them?
On the New York Review of Books also, right. my patron saints.
When you do that kind of work, do you have a purpose in mind or are you, I'm just recording this?
You know, with that one, I just wanted to get it down. I mean, I think I could say I have all sorts of socially improving purposes, but ultimately, I think all artists are motivated by a fundamental greed to capture life and a fundamental greed to draw. And, you know, if I do something improving, that's cherry on top. But I just wanted to capture it.
Yeah. I have beside me Brothers of the Gun, which is your latest book.
Yes.
And it's a collaboration with Marwan Hisham.
Yes.
Who's a really amazing Syrian writer. Can you tell us what Brothers of the Gun is about?
Brothers of the Gun is Marwan's memoir that starts in the early days of the revolution with him flinging back tear gas canisters at the cops and takes the reader through the decimation of the revolution's hopes and through the occupation by ISIS.
Right. When you read this, you go inside Raqqa, which was physically impossible for a lot of, certainly Westerners, for most of us in the world. But he brings you in there.
Absolutely. I mean, Marwan and I, we started working together in 2014 when we only knew each other through Twitter. And he had, I think, the only account that was tweeting in English from inside ISIS-occupied Raqqa. I was learning Arabic and he was helping me with that. And then one day I asked him, I said, you know, Marwan, do you have any photos on your phone just showing your life in Raqqa? And he said, I don't, but I can take some. And I said, isn't that going to be dangerous, Marwan? And he's like, nah, it's my city. Don't worry about it. You know, lying, of course.
Yeah.
And he went around risking his life to take these photos that showed the truth of the ISIS occupation, you know, something he would have been probably beheaded on tape for. There was so little space for like a working class Syrian dude to publish his thoughts in the U.S. publishing industry. that was a shame. And so we decided to create this together, and we co-wrote it together. I drew it, but he art directed it. I consider the illustrations also equally his, because he...
Oh, interesting.
Well, you know, it's not like I had photos for most of them.
Yeah.
For most of them, he was explaining what he saw to me, and then I'm doing sketches, and then he's telling me I'm wrong and giving me reference and, you know, back and forth.
Of course, you know, we're dealing with a book that was in, you know, all the horrors of ISIS, but there's also this one illustration that really stuck with me, which is he's talking about his garden. Like, for a while, I guess people do all sorts of things to cope with, like, living under that kind of stress.
Yeah, I wanted to draw the sprouts. And even though there is, you know, horrors of the type that I have never experienced in my life, people also live and they also fall in love and they plant gardens and they try to, you know, make lives for themselves. And I've often felt that sometimes the view of America towards countries in the Arab world is that these are perpetually war-torn countries. And because of that, it almost makes America more comfortable bombing them, because they think, oh, these countries are just always war-torn. These countries are always rubble. These countries don't have anything of value.
So speaking of rubble, let's check in on your drawing of my face. How's it coming along?
It's going good. It's
awesome,
going good.
Molly.
I've been drawing this very complicated microphone in front of you.
Yeah, I know. I think it's an Omni mic, whatever. So it goes all the way around. But yeah, sometimes people come to comedy shows and draw us. But this one, this is incredible.
Thank you.
Yeah. They're often like really hammered as they're drawing.
Oh, God. Okay. There's nothing worse than when someone draws you and it's bad and you have to like kind of smile. I've had this, like, people will draw me and my nose look like, it looks like an upside down six or something, you know? I look like some sort of misogynistic caricature. And I'm like, oh, thank you. That looks great. Really, please don't post that.
So could you describe your drawing style for people that can't see what you're doing right now?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I have a specific school. I think I'm someone who's incredibly impatient, and that's why I draw so fast, which turned out to be very good for journalism, because I could get things down really fast, you know, before people moved or before a cop found out what I was doing.
Yeah.
I was very influenced by Toulouse-Lautrec, the French painter who did the Can-Can stuff, and by Aubrey Beardsley, by Diego Rivera, Goya, Ralph Steadman, obviously.
So one recent work of yours that went viral is this very cool video by Naomi Klein and The Intercept. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is narrating her vision of the Green New Deal. And we see this time-lapse footage, and it's you illustrating what she's saying. It's just like your hand holding a paintbrush, using ink and watercolors, and then those drawings come to life before our eyes as she's speaking.
Yeah.
Ah, the bullet train from New York to D.C.,
so it starts out with AOC sitting in this like sleek, modern, super cool, you know, bullet train, looking a little bit older. She has a Susan Sontag streak of white
Love
in her
it.
Hair. Very cool white tailored suit. And what we wanted to do with this video is we wanted to give this feeling of time travel.
The wave began when Democrats took back the House in 2018, and then the Senate and the White House in 2020, and launched the decade of the Green New Deal.
It was so cool, because usually what the subjects I focus on, they're often about, you know, prisons, incarceration of immigrants, incredibly grim, tragic things. And it was really nice to be able to do something that was utopian.
Right. Right. And then, like, I love how she's like, the children, you know, in our communities are so excited. And then there's like cute little cutouts of just like happy kids.
Yeah, exactly. Like happy little girls.
I'll never forget the children in our community. They were so inspired to see this new class of politicians who reflected them navigating the halls of power.
One of the things that was kind of funny about the reaction to this video was I drew, you know, people of all sorts of backgrounds in this video. There's blonde people, there's black people, there's Latinas, there's, you know, Asian people, people of every type. And yet, when this was released, these conservatives became convinced that there were no white people in
really?
The video. Yeah. And they became convinced that the video was about white genocide.
Oh, God.
And they would even post screenshots that had, like, white people in them and say that they weren't there. And it just made, it was such an illustration of how if there's any sort of equity and representation, these people are just triggered and have a giant freak out.
Oh, my God.
I mean, one thing that for me, my favorite part in it is towards the end, I drew this image of Grand Army Concourse in the Bronx.
We can be whatever we have the courage to see.
But with, you know, community gardens and like community musicians everywhere and solar panels and bullet train, all that sort of stuff. And I was kind of sick of images of the future that looked like Dubai. I wanted something that looked like the actual, you know, city that I, you know, come from, which is New York, and that kept the most beautiful parts of, you know, our heritage as New Yorkers while also bringing in the parts to make it a sustainable future.
Yeah. How are you feeling about being in New York? You seem to travel a lot. So do you feel like you live here?
I do. I mean, I'm from New York and I'm from Far Rockaway originally. And my family's lived here for like over 100 years on my mom's side and my dad's side since, you know, his dad immigrated, you know, to get a factory job in the 50s. And so I do feel like it is my home and probably always will be. And I love this city. And I was trying to think about why I loved New York so much, despite so many problems that it has and so many infuriating things. And what I liked about New York is that New York is a city where anyone can become a New Yorker. You don't have to learn English to be a New Yorker. You don't have to change, you know, the clothing of the country that you're from. You can be from anywhere in the world. You can practice whatever religion. As long as you are a tough hustler, you are a New Yorker. Like the dude from Ghana who is selling, you know, purses in on Canal Street is a New Yorker. Becky from Connecticut is not a New Yorker. And to me, it is this perfect example of how you can have inclusiveness and belonging without this forcible assimilation.
Right.
So I have a question for you, actually. So you're an immigrant, but you're a European immigrant, which is always in a slightly different category. Is there pressure for you to assimilate in America?
The pressure from me comes from Irish America, where they're so thrilled to see me. And these are like, you know, third, fourth, fifth generation Irish Americans. Then I start talking about what I think and how I'm feeling when I'm here and also about what Ireland is like at the moment. We were the first country to legalize same-sex marriage. Like, we just got abortion, thank God. Like, it's not like we're some progressive beacon, but a lot of Europe is moving to the right and Ireland isn't. Meanwhile, Irish America is moving and is the very much established right. So, I mean, Mike Pence loves his Irishness.
Oh, God.
I know. We're so proud of him, Molly.
I didn't even know he was Irish. I mean, maybe I'm cruelly stereotyping, but I thought that there was no one more white Anglo-Saxon Protestant in the world, you know?
Isn't it funny?
Yeah, yeah.
But no, he's not. He's very proud of his Irish granddad. He often uses this poor man. And he was like, you need to be like my grandfather. Like, he came from Mayo in 1921 and
God.
He pulled himself up by his bootstraps.
My grandfather came here because he believed in the promise of America. And he lived it. He drove a bus for 40 years in Chicago, Illinois. He raised my precocious mother, who's still 85 years young. But we lived the American dream.
Yeah, like, that's a cute story, but he leaves out some things. Like, in 1921, there was a civil war in Ireland, so wasn't he lucky he was allowed in? Not like the poor Assyrians today.
Yes.
But Molly, don't get me started on Mike Pence. It looks like you're finished your drawing of me now.
Indeed, I have.
I love it, Molly.
Thank you.
Like, I'm so chuffed that you would even, like, I feel like I should, I don't know what I can do, write a routine about you or something.
Oh, dear.
Pay you in jokes or something. But this is so great. And you got my hair and everything. I look quite stricken.
I blame myself, not you. The mic looks slightly insectoid. I think you were looking up. You might have been speaking about being expected to conform to Irish American stereotypes at that moment.
That would definitely explain my face. Don't adopt me, Mike Pence. That's what I'm saying. Don't claim me as your own. Thank you so much for the drawing and for your insight and for the work that you do.
Thank you so much. This was so much fun.
Thanks, Molly. Brothers of the Gun by Marwan Hisham and Molly Crabapple is in bookstores now, and you can see the drawing that Molly made of me on studio360.org.